Morning, everybody. Thanks for all showing up, the first talk of the first day. I'll try to make it a little bit enticing. People who know me well know that I'm not a morning person. So I'm going to try to make it a little bit enticing for myself as well as for you so we can all stay awake for this early morning talk. What I'm going to do here is soil organic carbon as a topic has become an in thing to do, and so there's a lot of interest in understanding what happens to soil organic carbon in view of greenhouse gas emissions mitigation as well as long-term carbon sequestration. And so what I would like to do with my talk today is I'm going to be less factual in terms of, you know, overloading you with a lot of data. I'll leave that to people later in the program. But what I would like to do this morning is actually approach it a little bit from a philosophical standpoint and give you some ideas. Debunk some myths, or what did I say? Throw some dogmas for the dogs. And so that's what I'm going to do. So big disclaimer here, some of the evidence that I will pull in is actually not just mine, and some of the ideas are not just mine. They're the result of discussions and collaborations with colleagues as well as with my graduate students. So they are they're equally due some credit for what I'm presenting right here. So my approach is I'm going to take in my talk the approach that I'm actually taking in my teaching, that is to particularly in lower level classes, I'm trying to convince the students that they actually already know a lot of things, that they just don't know that they know it. And so my approach with this talk here is that we as soil scientists actually know a lot of things, and we have known it for a long time, except that we have missed the boat. And we have missed the boat in applying some of our past knowledge to relevant or current issues. And we basically have let other people shanghai the topic. And so I will bring to you hopefully some food for thought. Hopefully I don't terribly offend people. I apologize in advance if I do, but I want to go back to the basics. So, as soil scientists, if we have taught an introductory class, we've all kind of put this up somewhere in some guise or form. That is, the factors of soil formation. Soils are the reflection of climate, plant material, topography, parent material, and we throw in time a little bit. And those are ideas, by the way. I mean, Hans Jenny wrote his Factors of Soil Formation in 1947. That is seven decades ago. And Vasily Dokuchaev was actually working on some of those same concepts in the late 1800s. So we've had quite a number of decades to really digest it and to apply it. And so one of the things that we kind of say to ourselves, yeah, you know, these are the factors of soil formation, and they're not independent of one another. They co-occur, they co-vary, and yet, when we're talking about soil organic carbon, and particularly the way we model what is going to happen to these soil carbon stores in the future under changing environments, by and large, we focus on the inputs. Oops, I shouldn't laser myself here. We focus on the inputs and how climate will influence net primary productivity. And then we focus on the losses or decomposition and how climate is going to influence that. At best, we will actually bring in the concept of vegetation in determining net primary productivity in conjunction with climate. But very seldom do we see the influence, for example, of vegetation in modifying soil climate. We look at ambient climate, and we then apply this and say, well, it's good, we're good. And very seldom, actually, do we see any soil properties show up in these conceptual frameworks, right? So I think we missed the boat there. Okay. So that the first slide was evidence A. This is evidence B. That is, if we are teaching soil genesis, poster child number one, the mollisol or Chernozem, if you're so inclined. And here we explain that, you know, in soil organic matter, the way the soil organic matter stabilizes is because we have a formation of a molic horizon that is the result of root material from grasses that occur in semi-arid environments, and that organic matter stabilizes with the mineral soil to form a molic epipedon. And we actually talk about this interaction between soil organic matter and the mineral soil as a way in which this A horizon gets formed. Now, soil organic matter, soil organic carbon, I mean, it's really not a very big leap to make. Okay, poster child number two, the spodosol or the podzol in any other classification system. What do we get here? Again, we get the co-occurrence of climate, vegetation, and soil as a mechanism by which this soil organic carbon gets stabilized. Now we're talking about an environment where we have an accumulation of O-horizon material, and that is usually due to the co-occurrence of particular vegetation types that deliver organic material that has particular chemical characteristics in conjunction with environmental constraints that lead to an impartial decomposition. Followed, so I'm giving you the cliff notes on podzolization here, which probably I don't need to do for any of you. But the important part here is that some of that material that originates in the O horizon is actually hydrologically transported and stabilizes deeper in the soil in terms of a spodic horizon. So here we have the principle that, yes, the soil organic carbon may come from the O horizon, but it gets into the mineral soil through hydrological processes, and the stabilization is not happening in the surface, but in the deeper horizons. Yet, so if we summarize then what we know already, but that we sometimes fail to apply, is that we understand that there are different stabilization mechanisms that involve not only O-horizon material, but also roots, that involve dissolved organic carbon, that are led or influenced by climate and particularly hydrological processes, as well as soil properties. So we have a good recipe for an actual conceptual model of how carbons get sequestered. Then why do the main models that we use look like this? Right? So in the United States, we have the most widely used model is the Century model. If you're in Europe, the most widely used model is the YASO model. Both of them have essentially, fundamentally, the same structure. That is, they talk about origin of material. So they talk about origin of material and also the chemistry of that material, whether it has lignin or not. And in essence, carbon or the transformation of that carbon is expressed in terms of decay constants or decomposition constants that may be under the influence of climate and to a large extent also dependent on the source material. So that would be, do you have your fine woody litter, do you have your coarse woody litter, or in the case of the century model, do you have structural, what kind of material do you have here? And soil at best, in Yasuo it doesn't show up. In century, soil will actually show up as a modifier at best. And so in this case here, the current models that are used to give us an idea of what is happening to soil organic matter in the mineral soil is fundamentally a decomposition model. It speaks to the microbial decomposition of material. Now, that is not to be equated with stabilization. That is, there are connections, but the two are not identical. If you're speaking to stabilization, where is the solid-solution interaction? Where is that in our current models? Where is the hydrology and hydrologic transport? Where is the reflection of a below-ground soil environment? It's not there. So I'm going to talk about a couple of zombie ideas. We just passed Halloween. We've come down from our sugar high. I think it's appropriate to talk about zombie ideas. It's not a term, by the way, that I've coined. A speaker recently came to the Ecology Center seminar and spoke about zombie ideas. Zombie ideas are ideas that should be dead. They should be dead. They refuse to die, and periodically they come alive. Okay, so that's really what I kind of want to address here is some of these ideas that always come up in the question-answer session of any seminar that relates to the mineral soil. So, first idea, zombie idea, is what you see above ground happens below ground. Okay, now it's understandable that we're trying to make sense out of a world that we can't see. And we do that. We do that every time we do new science. Every time we do new science, we try to explain something we have not observed yet, or we don't fully understand, and we do that with the things we know. And so, by and large, many concepts of what is happening below ground find their origin in observations and principles from what we see above ground. And I'm kind of saying, let's put that baby to rest. Okay? So, first example of that is when we're talking about roots or below ground processes. And when we try to represent what is happening below ground, we always assume, or we always represent below ground processes as fundamentally mimicking above ground processes. That is, more and net primary productivity above. Most of the time, we express our below ground dynamics with allometrics that are from the above ground. Even though there is evidence out there, and I hope that there will be some later on in this symposium, we have evidence out there in the literature that the above-below-ground allometrics or proportions are not constant, not for a particular tree species with age, not for a particular tree species by site condition. So we actually have, and I was almost inclined to put some of the work up from the 1980s that was done in at the University of Washington, but then I kind of said, well, I've already got enough slides, so I'm not going to go there. But in essence, we still keep on putting the 20% in there. He said, roots 20% above ground. It's good enough for government work. So, and I think that's a fundamental flaw. Secondly, is also the idea that what is happening in the O horizon is also happening in the mineral soil. That is, that accumulation, soil organic carbon accumulation patterns in the O horizons and the dynamics in the O horizons are also mimicked below ground. So more O horizon means more mineral soil, soil carbon, less O horizon, less mineral soil. So in particular, some of the things that show up, and I put a disclaimer here for the young impressionable minds. Please do not write this down, because I will debunk every single one of them, okay? Or at least I will make an attempt. That is, conifers, by the fact that they have a thicker O horizon, also store more carbon in the mineral soil. Secondly, soil organic matter in under conifers is inherently more stable because of the chemistry of the litter material it's coming from, and plant origin and recalcitrance are important to soil organic carbon stabilization. It's the infusion again of the decomposition model to the stabilization process, which is, in my view, inappropriate. So, now I'm going to start debunking. All right. So, first work done by my graduate student on Trabocha, who recently did a meta-analysis comparing adjacent conifers and hardwood stands from a number of studies across the world. Just kind of a how this meta-analysis representation works. If it's on the zero line, there is no difference between hardwoods and conifers. If you're sitting on the positive side, that means more under the hardwood. If you're sitting on the negative side, more under conifers. What she's finding is indeed conifers accumulate more O horizon material. Whoop-de-doo, we've seen that one before. Okay, but what is interesting that there is absolutely no correlation between what's happening in the forest soil and the mineral soil. And as a matter of fact, when she did the statistical analysis on that, she could not find that the forest floor in any way or form was a predictor of what was going on in the mineral soil. She continued some of that work further on and said, well, I'm going to actually break it down by genus, so I will not just look at hardwoods, but groupings of hardwoods. And what she found in this analysis, so this would mean Betula, the genus Betula, against all the conifers it is companioned with. This would be the Picea against all the hardwoods that are have been studied. And what she's finding that, first of all, that there is as much variability within a grouping as between groupings. So that's one. And that actually there are eucalypts, for example, does stand out as accumulating more carbon in the mineral soil. And amongst the conifers, the only one that actually is statistically significant is Picea or spruce. The rest is really not fundamentally different from zero. So her results have shown that plant genus traits may be better predictors than these generalizations that we tend to make about conifers and hardwoods. This was followed up, or this was actually preceded by work that was done by one of my master's students in Utah, where we did plot-level comparisons between aspen, Populus tremuloides, and adjacent conifer stands. And the open bars represent the O horizon, the solid bars represent the mineral soil, And each of these are different locations or different sites. What we're finding is that for the O-horizon, yes, indeed, conifers statistically significantly accumulate more O-horizon material, but in the mineral soil, it's consistently the opposite. That is, aspen is actually accumulating more soil organic carbon in the mineral soil to a depth of 60 centimeters, despite the fact that the opposite pattern is observed in the O-horizon. Second part of her work then was to say, well, let's address this issue of soil organic stability or decomposability. And here we did long-term incubation, same sites, same generic representation, green is the conifers, red is the aspen, and here what we have represented is the cumulative CO2 evolution after 10 months of the incubation per gram of carbon in the soil, meaning what is the relative decomposability of that carbon that is in the soil. Higher bars would mean more decomposable, smaller bars would be less decomposable. The message is actually clear. The soil organic carbon under conifers, in this case, is actually more decomposable, not less decomposable, despite what we see in the O horizon. So it is therefore less stable in the sense that is represented by the decomposition models. We did some follow-up on that, both Mikal did, and then a follow-up by Mercedes Romando Barco, and they actually did a fractionation where they tried to figure out where is this carbon. And what we're seeing here is that consistently, when we look at the mineral associated, that is, that soil organic matter that is attached to the clay and silt, surfaces is always significantly higher under aspen than it is to the companion conifer site. And so that was also further borne out when we did not, when we went beyond pairwise comparisons, but actually looked at mixed stands, and what we are representing here is mixed stands with increasing predominance of aspen in the live basal area. We see that there is actually a positive correlation between aspenness of the mixed stand and mineral-associated carbon. And across all our data sets, we find that there is an inverse correlation between the decomposability and the mineral stabilization of that carbon, indicating in this case that the stabilization here is due to an interaction with the solid phase that reduces access of the microbes to that carbon. So, going back to our zombie ideas, gone. So let's now talk about the role of recalcitrance, which we typically kind of put forward in our models. And the idea here is that the factors that control decomposition in the O horizon are exactly the same as the factors that control the stability or the decomposition in the mineral horizon. And I would say, well, why on earth would you believe that? Okay? Because this is what the structure of the model says. What it is, a decomposition model, and the decomposition model is driven by climate, by chemistry of the substrate, and superimpose that microbial activity. But climate in the mineral soil is not climate of the O horizon. It is not. Never will be. Okay? So secondly, vegetation modifies that ambient climate. If we look at microbial activity, the microbes live in a different environment. The fact that you have a mineral matrix presence changes gas diffusion. It changes hydrology. It changes the solution phase chemistry and the diffusion of materials. It is not an O-horizon environment. Litter chemistry, when we look at what is happening in the mineral soil, the soil organic carbon that we're looking at has already been modified by microorganisms. It is not a chunk of litter that is sitting there. It's something that has been processed. So to deal with that, Mercedes just finished her analysis using Fourier infrared, Fourier transformed infrared spectroscopy. Mouthful. Basically, it's a tool that you can use to look at the composition of your organic material. It is very much like NMR or whatever techniques. It is the principles by which the analysis is done that matters. The idea is when you use those kind of spectra that the presence absence of peaks will tell you presence of absence of compounds. Okay, what is represented here is organic material as a whole. The light fraction, that is the material that has been separated, that are the chunks that are still recognizable. And then we have the mineral-associated material, and we have that for soils that come from aspen, from conifers, and mixed. Okay. All right. You don't need statistical analysis. You can eyeball this and say, well, it looks about the same to me. Right? Basically saying that if we look at the various presence absences of peaks, they're the same. We're basically talking about the same minestrone soup, right? The same compounds are there. The only difference that we find or that we can use is actually the peak height. And so the peak height is a semi-quantitative metric to tell you there is something more of that. This region here would be representing the more recalcitrant materials. When you look at this, there is very little difference between soil organic carbon under conifers and soil organic carbon under aspen. What we're seeing, however, that there is a slightly higher peak under aspen, and they're mostly polysaccharides. They're the simple sugars. They're the simple stuff, not the recalcitrant, not the very complex molecules. Now, this has also recently, we also have found two other articles that talk exactly about the same idea, that is that you get qualitative convergence of soil organic carbon and that you have a biological filtering that is going on, and that filtering is actually done by the microbes, so that the origin of your material is less important than what the microbes are doing with it. What we're finding is that in that stabilized soil organic carbon, recalcitrance is not important. As a matter of fact, it's entirely irrelevant. And so when we look at our fractionation here, where we're using a simple fractionation where we do wet sieving, separate the fine material or the mineral associated, then the coarser material, there we actually separate with electrostatic attraction. And what we're finding here is that when you go from the light fraction, you will still see some, you might still see somewhat of a vegetation imprint. but when you're actually going to the mineral-associated carbon, which seems to be the location where stabilization occurs, we have increased microbial processing and reduced vegetation imprint. So the vegetation as such is not a determining factor anymore. So, scratch that one out. So, okay, students, you can write this down now. Right? So, in effect, all these ideas that we have applied to the mineral soil as coming from the O horizon are basically erroneous. We should not continue to let these zombies live. Let them die and start afresh. Okay. Now, I've been told that I'm by some of my superiors that I'm overly negative, all right? So I wanna end my talk with constructive comments, because this is hardly constructive. So let's go back to our roots, pun intended, kind of. Let's go back to the things we know. And the things we know is that stabilization is a result of an interplay between things that have the soil matrix, between climatic conditions where roots and DOC and hydrology play a role. So we have to go underground. This was Mercedes just before she defended. So just, you know, this is my graduate student abuse. Dale, you never did that to me. So you got that one right. So sources of stable carbon, either it can come from above ground as litter, or it can come from below ground as roots. And we will hear Nadelhofer talk about the DIRT project, and that is exactly what they're trying to get at, is what is the relative contribution of this. If it's coming in, unless you have bioturbation, most of your litter material is actually going to come in through hydrologic redistribution, that is, of decomposition products. And that can also be, when I use the word roots, I actually mean rhizosphere, both rhizodeposition and exudates and rhizosphere organisms. So that's the kind of the focus that my current student is taking through a combination of lysimetry, mini rhizotrons to actually see where the roots are, root distributions, then some adsorption studies and biomarkers. And I want to share hot off the press, super duper preliminary, Jeff. This is work that Antra actually did with Jeff Hatton at Oregon State, and where she's using derivatives of suberin and cutein as potential biomarkers for origin. And so the idea is here, is it so that the roots and the foliage have basically different signatures? And if they do, then can we find those signatures in the mineral soil? Now, this is super duper preliminary data. So what I'm going to show you is just for aspen. We've done the same thing for conifers, and it's totally eyeballing. So we have not done the full analysis on the biomarkers yet, but I just want you to look at this spectrogram and this spectrogram. Just eyeballing, I would say, there's some differences, right? There's a couple of peaks that in one place that are not in there. So that's hopeful. And then we're looking at 10 centimeters and deeper, and we're also finding that there are some differences there too. So there is a possibility that what happens in superficial soils and deeper soils is slightly different, or they may have different origins. So there are differences. So I'm going to kind of guide you through a couple of things that I can see eyeballing. This peak here is not showing up for leaves. So that would be a good identifier of root material, What do we see? We see it showing up in the deeper soil and to a lesser extent in the mineral soil, which would actually speak to the greater contribution of the roots in the deeper mineral soil. Likewise, this peak region here also shows up here. And then we have this peak region looks very identical, both superficial as well as deeper. And then we look at material that can be indicative of leaves. It's not showing up here, and we also see it showing up here in the mineral soil. And this peak here somehow disappears or gets attenuated. So I think there's some hope there that we can actually have that information combined with visual data on roots, root distribution, and we were also going to look at biomarkers in the soil solutions. The other thing that we're working on right now, and this was actually a study that was started with an undergraduate, is actually use materials, hydrologic material or extract that are derived from roots and foliage, and see whether indeed they absorb to the soil surfaces. And so this is the first proof of principle that we obtained with some leaf material, that there is actually very nice adsorption curves that we can obtain. So that's kind of my 5 cents worth. I do apologize if I offended anybody, but I really think that some things needed to be said. And it would be a call to arms to all soil scientists. Do not be ignored. Let your voices be heard, and let our knowledge be included in the models. Thank you.